Today on Flashpoints, we have part one of a special report on last week's U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, where around 15,000 beautiful activists, organizers, and people who are simply sick and tired of being sick and tired came together to network, strategize, and create local, regional, and national goals. On today's special, we'll hear testimonials about the devastation occurring in people's communities around the country. Also, we'll hear about a new exciting domestic workers alliance that's been built at the U.S. Social Forum. Finally, we'll end the show with Radio Flash, that is, Flashpoints en Español, also featuring sounds from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. I'm Jesse Strauss with this special U.S. Social Forum edition of Flashpoints. All this straight ahead. Stay tuned. Those are sounds from the opening march of the U.S. Social Forum, which happened on Tuesday, June 22nd. Again, I'm Jesse Strauss, reporting on the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. To start our special off today, we'll hear an opening poem, which explains to this youth how important the U.S. Social Forum is.
Not more laws, a wage we can live off of, not a life sentence behind bars. And what's the reason? Because the pigment of my skin doesn't quite fit in the white Anglo-Saxon normative? That must be it. See, I ain't no fool. I know exactly why you're stopping me on my way to school. See, I may fit your description, but unlike you think, I speak with conviction. Let me break it down for you in a way that you'll understand. Contrary to popular belief, black and brown are hustling their way to the first in their class. As we break out of school walls, liberate our colonized minds, and meet here at the U.S. Social Forum, taking cues from the ones that came before us, screaming from the top of our lungs, we fired up, we won't take it no more.
We fired up, we won't take it no more. What? We fired up, we won't take it no more. We fired up, we won't take it no more.
Hey, yo, are you with me or are you with them? The masses have been waiting for you to take a stand. Cause the students are taking up arms, well equipped with strategies and tactics to make the right a little nervous, a little frantic. And yo, can you hook me up with a weapon? Cause I know the left is doing something right when more and more black and brown students are defying the school to prison pipeline. And mujeres are rising up, ready to organize the people from the ground up. And yo, can you give me that kind of protection? Where you put people over profits, the earth over instant gratification, and education over incarceration. Where you don't simply see me as another who can't answer the question, but see me as an investment, a diamond in the rough worth the extra attention. And yo, give me a weapon, one that no police, no matter how much they search me, could find, and one that has bullets that transcend through time, the kind that never die, you know, that revolutionary kind. I'm talking about ideas whose sounds create a wave of revival that breaks down racist border walls and sends thousands marching down to end this oppressive cycle. And yo, I need a lesson how to use this weapon because things are different now. Cherry Moraga, Cesar Chavez, Angela Davis, Hugo Chavez, Frida Kahlo, Malcolm X, can you teach me how to deal with this new president? Because he looks like you and me, but he has a few lessons to learn about accountability to his community. Mm. Rosa Parks, Gloria Saldúa, Bell Hooks, Artie Lorde, Emiliano Zapata, Comandante Ramona, can you teach me how to deal with this new president? Because though I believe in the movement that elected him, I know that this can't be the end. It's going to take more than just Obama to revolutionize the system, because I still wake up frightened, still affected by the violence. Hey, yo, are you with me or are you with them? The answer is simple. Si se puede, yes, we can. With this clipboard, this voice, this soul, and these hands, I'm ready to rise. I'm ready to revolutionize. Hey, yo, are you with me?
The next voice you'll hear is that of Colin Raja of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. He explains the importance of the U.S. Social Forum, how it was created, and what he's trying to do there.
My name is Colin Raja. I'm with the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. We are a member of Grassroots Global Justice, and we are also a member of GGJ's Globalization and Migration Working Group. One of the contexts of how GGJ came about is essentially what we're here to talk about today. During the first and second World Social Forums, which was a response to the World Economic Forum, an exclusive event for business leaders and government leaders that's held annually in the city of Davos, Switzerland. As a response to that, the World Social Forum was held and came together. And as organizations, grassroots organizations from around the US, we experienced this phenomenal forum that was so in contrast to the World Economic Forum and everything that it stood for, that we said, we need to come together. We need, as grassroots organizations and movements in the US, we need to come together within this global context with our partners internationally and globally. And that's how GGJ was formed today. And the context of what GGJ still stands for today is very much why we're here to talk about the G20. The G20 and the World Economic Forum is not even enough. Now there's a proposal to talk about the New York Forum, an even more exclusive body, a body that's going to talk about how can we cut corners, how can we cut budgets in this economic recession, and what we, the people, need to do to tighten our belts even further. It's a story that's very much in contrast to the 20,000 of us here and what we're talking about and what we're trying to do. We're talking about how can we enrich our souls, our lives, and how we can share our ecology with each other and take care of it in a sustainable and respectful and responsible manner. This is why we're here. This is what the social forum is all about. And in response to, in direct contrast to this event that's happening in Toronto, beginning today and tomorrow, the G20 meeting will again, as they have every year, as they have in the past, will be talking about how these exclusive government leaders of just 20 countries in the world that represent less than 15% of the world's population, let alone represent only the business leaders and other cronies that they are directly accountable to, not the real citizens. These business leaders and these government leaders will be talking again about how they can respond in an economic recession to maintain or even expand their power. Issues around military cooperation will be on the agenda. Issues around trade agreements will be on the agenda. Issues around migration will be on the agenda as well, something new that's been coming up in the last few years. But very much different in terms of the goals, what they're approaching to, and what they're trying to accomplish. We have the same issues on our agenda too here in the US Social Forum. We have issues of ecology on the agenda. We have issues of the economy on the agenda. We have issues of migration on the agenda. In fact, if you just look at the Social Forum program, we have three or four People's Movement assemblies talking about these issues. But how we're talking about it and what we're approaching in terms of it are starkly different in terms of what the G20 is approaching. The G20 consistently looks at how we can further exploit, further criminalize, and further use and dispose of people. This is evident in terms of the free markets that they have been developing over the last 30 or 40 years. This is evident in terms of the free trade agreements or economic partnership agreements that have been developing over the last 10 to 15 years. And this is very much evident in terms of legislation and federal laws, as well as local laws that have been passed just in the past couple of weeks. This is the kind of things that we would like to talk about in this social forum, to explore, to demand accountability from our governments that are supposedly representing us in Toronto. We want to say, just as we were able to in Cochabamba just a couple of months ago during the climate summit, we were able to sit down with governments and say, this is what we think is the right thing to do, and this is how we should do it. And we're able to dialogue directly with governments. We demand that little bit of opportunity to do that, at the very least. We have 20,000 people here and many more thousands all over the country and around the world who are looking to this opportunity at this US Social Forum. Not for that opportunity at the G20, because we know it won't happen. So we take this opportunity today to highlight all the very many workshops, the 1,000 over workshops, the 50 over People's Movement assemblies that have been coming up in this social forum. We ask us all, especially members of the media, to look forward to Saturday, when we will synthesize dozens of ongoing resolutions that have been developed, been drafted, been worked on for weeks and months before this, that are still being worked on and will be worked on right to the last minute on Saturday morning. We ask you to look to that for these answers. For the answers to our ecology, for the answers to our economy, for the answers to our migration and empire, but he answers that come up from the bottom, from the people itself, a bottom-up approach. We ask you to disregard the top-down answers, which have proven time and time again to fail, that is coming from the G20. And we ask you also to listen to our brothers and sisters from around the world. And this is the cornerstone of this U.S. Social Forum. If there's anything we can take away from this U.S. Social Forum, is that we're not just talking about what's happening in our local area. We're not just talking about what's happening around the country. We're talking with other movements from around the world. We have this enormous opportunity that we otherwise wouldn't have to hear from people from around the world who are engaged in the same struggles that we're engaged in. People trying to answer the same questions we are confronting. People coming up with amazing and creative answers to ecology, to economy, to empire. So we ask you to please focus on what we have to say and help us convey this message to our so-called leaders. Convey this message to the G20 and what it stands for. All the way over in Toronto, all the way back to Geneva, all the way to Davos next year, and all across to the New York Forum that will be held later on. We ask you to communicate this message to our leaders and say, we have answers. The answers are right here. All we need you to say is listen and be accountable to us.
Reporting from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, I'm Jesse Strauss. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Tens of thousands of activists, organizers, students, and creative people have come together here to build movement for social change. As participants hope that the events over the next few days will inform their ideas of movement strategy, the workshop I attended today began the U.S. Social Forum in a reflection of what is going on in people's own communities. The workshop, organized by STOP, Southside Together for Power, which is from Chicago, offered space for participants to give testimony about their own experiences and what they are struggling with in their local movements. What you'll hear in a few moments is a selection of those testimonies. Notice that the people speaking up are dealing with a wide variety of movements and their challenges of movement building.
One of the publications that has done an amazing job, I don't know how many people in the room know Left Turn. It's a great space that's featured the story of the sit-in at the mayor's office when we saved the mental health mix. It's featured a lot of other stories, great space for discussion. We have one of the editors here, and he wanted to give a brief testimony, Jordan Clarin.
I live in New Orleans, and I think we've seen a lot of these same struggles people have seen in other cities, but for us it was kind of on hyperspeed. They took advantage of the fact that the entire city was displaced by Hurricane Katrina to push forward these things that they could never have done if a city of people were there to rise up and stop them. So for example, if you look at the school system, we basically went overnight to this charter system. So before the storm, we had 128 schools in the system, and 124 were under the control of the school board. After the, after Katrina, all the students were of course gone, the teachers were gone. Overnight, they fired the entire school system. All the teachers, 5,000 teachers, and the rest of the staff. The school union was actually probably the largest source of black political power in the city. It was the largest black union in the city. That union was officially derecognized with all those people out of town. All the contracts they had, the seniority, all that, they were all fired. And they basically had to come and reapply for their jobs if they wanted them, competing with these Teach for America kids, basically kids from these Ivy League schools, were one of the major sites of Teach for America in the country. Last year's 500 Teach for America kids coming in, basically. So basically, these veteran teachers had to apply against these old kids. They lost any of their benefit, their seniority. And the system very quickly went over to this charter system. So as I mentioned, there's 128 schools before, 124 of them under the school board. Now there's four schools under the school board. There's about 60 schools total. The majority of them are charters, and the rest are under the state, which is trying to switch them over to charters. Healthcare system, the same thing. Louisiana was actually the only, the only state in the country that had a statewide free healthcare system for poor folks called the charity healthcare system. Charity Hospital had been under attack from these legislators forever, but with the storm, even though it wasn't damaged in the storm, it's like a 30-story building and the basement was damaged. They shut it down, they said they couldn't reopen it, and basically used that as this way to switch over to this this clinic system, which was sort of the step towards privatization. So all these changes they were able to do while people were gone, push it through while people were gone. Now that people are back, people are doing some really exciting organizing around it. Parents are organizing, youth are organizing. There's a great organization called Fire Youth Squad, which is a group of kids, mostly from some of the most underprivileged, or I would say overexploited schools. You know, because I think we say underprivileged, but really overexploited is a better way to look at it, right? Some of the most overexploited schools in the system that are organizing around these very issues, around better education for them. And you know, just to say one thing about charter, you know, as folks have mentioned, switching to charter on its face, you know, is not necessarily that, but you know, what does this really mean? And in New Orleans now, as in the past, there are some really great schools, some of the best ones in our state, and some really bad schools. I think we have more bad schools than a lot of other states, but anyway, you know, we have that mix. What this charter system means, basically, is that the best schools go to the best students, and the students that need the most support, the students that don't have parents at home that can advocate for them, research what the best schools are, apply to those schools early, and get them into the schools, those kids get the worst schools. So it's sort of, you know, it just furthers this divide on who gets what. Obviously, we think all the schools should be better, you know, and however we can do that would be good, but what we have in this system right now is that those with the least get the worst schools, and those with the most get the best schools. And that's basically how things are divided. I just see one thing I wanted to add on that. I just to also link this up nationally and internationally. So the person that masterminded this was Paul Vallis, who I believe came from Chicago.
Yeah.
So Paul Vallis now, people haven't heard, he's been contracted to look at the school system in Haiti and bring his reforms they brought him from Chicago to New Orleans to Haiti. So we see this as international too. And that I think previously they used to really test out these privatization schemes internationally and then slowly bring them into the US. But now I think they're just going full speed ahead, both in the US and internationally. Okay, thank you.
I'm really honored to have this next speaker with us. You know, every Monday, STOP members get together to do what we call our People's Education Sessions, where we take a step back from our local struggles and look at how's it all connected, what's the bigger picture, what's the system we're up against. And one, bringing together the last two speakers, actually. One time we were reading a Left Turn article about the Coalition to Save Our Public Libraries in Philadelphia, and we said if we took out public libraries in Philadelphia and replaced it with mental health clinics in Chicago, this could be word for word about our struggle. So it's an honor to have another representative of another victorious struggle that's just heating up. So
I'm Sarah with the Coalition to Save the Libraries in Philly. And in 2008, kind of in the fall, right, as the stock market was collapsing, our mayor announced that in the middle of the fiscal year, he was going to cut a ton of public services, including closing 11 of the public libraries, just by closing the buildings down. He announced in November, and he said he was going to close them by January 1st, 2009. And we were successful in stopping the closings. All 11 libraries are still open, so the whole system is still intact as it should be. But kind of what you all were saying about they left the buildings open, but they are just cutting so much funding. And it's a lot harder to build, I think, a media campaign or a public campaign when the buildings are open, but they're just being underfunded. So it's gone from like the libraries were open 5 days a week to now they're open 4 days a week. They want to cut them down to 3 days a week. And the reality is because of staffing shortages, they're really open less than that. They're not even really open when they say they're going to be. So we totally won. It was an amazing victory. That was kind of a combination of a legal strategy and also a lot of grassroots organizing with people threatening to have sit-ins in their libraries to keep them from closing. But at the same time, we're still dealing with the same budget cuts that everybody else is. And it's amazing to hear how similar these situations are everywhere. Like what you were talking about in Miami, what we have in Philly is a 10-year tax abatement, which means that like all new construction in Philly is not being taxed for 10 years.
Wow.
And most of the homes that are being built under this are very, very expensive homes in the central parts of the city. So all of these people who have some of the highest concentrations of wealth in the city are not paying taxes on their property. And so that's causing, so we've lost so much revenue because of that, and it's ongoing, they're not ending it. So we have talked a lot in the Library Coalition about taxes, because people were saying, well, if you're gonna say you wanna keep the libraries open, then you need to talk about like where you're gonna get the money from. And we've had a hard time balancing that, because on the one hand, we're kind of saying, well, you're the politicians, it's your responsibility. Like, we, none of us are paid to do the work that we do. Like, we don't have the resources to be able to do this. But on the other hand, some people have come up with suggestions. But I feel like it's been hard for us because tax structures are so confusing that, like, you lose most of the room when you start getting into talking about, like, complicated tax structures. No, I mean, it's not just that people are resistant to paying more taxes, it's also just, like, they make it very difficult for you to understand. And that's kind of been our experience with dealing with city council, city government in general, is it's, like, so difficult to understand that that it's just really hard to unify people around a tax campaign. And also with concerns that once you may make a suggestion, like we made a suggestion that was they start taxing nonprofits that were the large nonprofits, because there's a lot of universities in Philly that are not paying taxes, and the hospitals also don't pay taxes. And so we're also losing a lot of money that way. But then we got nervous that if we start saying, oh, to tax large nonprofits, they're actually gonna turn that into taxing maybe large nonprofits, but actually small nonprofits. So that's just, we're dealing with lots of the same things in this ongoing budget crisis.
They say cut back.
We say cut back.
So please, we're gonna take a few more testimonies. We wanna take a few more testimonies about the struggles you're facing, and then we're gonna move into a collective discussion about how do we take these different struggles that often feel so isolating, right? We're over here fighting our mayor to keep our mental health centers open. Our other brothers and sisters are fighting to stop charterization, to stop privatization. We heard about parking meters. How do we move from this feeling of being on our heels to being on our toes and having a proactive movement, trying to re-envision the way those services are funded and thought of in the first place? So I'm gonna turn the mic over.
I'm also from San Francisco. I'm from the Daily River Program, and Jose Ramirez is a member of. So just to add to what he's saying, you know, the perspective that he, or the picture that he paints in San Francisco is one of where they're cutting a lot of services, you know, mental health, et cetera. At the same time, though, what I wanted to comment, they're trying to pass a law in San Francisco that will make it illegal to sit or lie on public sidewalks from the hours of 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. Of course, you know, this is and they would get a $50 fine, and they could get up to 30 days in jail. And of course, you know, if we think about the irony of cutting mental health services, for example, cutting shelter services, and at the same time making it so you can't sit down, you know, if you're homeless, or a lot of these folks are also suffering from mental health issues, or a lot of them are laborers, like in our center, you know, who are standing to look for work since really early in the morning and have to sit down to take a break if they're not finding work, and criminalizing them, you know. So at the same time, you know, the day laborers are and other communities, instead of focusing on where the real issue is, on where the money's going and should be going, we're having to you know, go to hearings and fight the mayor, fight the district attorney, fight the police department on a silly law like sit lie, you know, and having to spend huge amount of staff and member time and resources into kind of these bogus laws that they're trying to criminalize at the same time that they're cutting their services. So I think that goes hand in hand with you know, trying to defend our communities from not only these cuts, but also from the criminalization of the same people that are getting affected by these cuts.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. I'm representing the Day Laborers Congress in New Orleans, where every worker wakes up every day with the worry of not having a stable job, and they have to go out onto the street corner on the Lowe's or the
Hollywood Street
to look for a day or maybe just a few hours of work. We suffer from hunger. There's people who don't have anywhere to live, who are just having to shack up with others. And it's very unjust, the laws that they have against us. Against all human beings.
Estamos viviendo un colapso no solo económico, sino que trato humanitario para el ser humano.
We're living through not just an economic crisis, but one really a crisis of the human being, of the treatment of human beings.
Y la razón que estoy aquí pues pasé accidentalmente entrando aquí porque me cansé, no hallé mi lugar donde iba, pero.
And the reason I ended up in here is because I got tired. I couldn't get to the place where I was going.
Pero estoy oyendo que.
But from what I'm hearing, the injustice that's happening in New Orleans is happening all over the United States.
Y es el camino que todos creo que estamos buscando es buscar justicia social, económica y.
I think the path that all of us are looking for is to look for social justice, economic justice, dignity.
Y cuando nosotros también pasamos grandes calazos por el suelo económico y social.
The great crisis because of the economic
situation.
And also because of the immigration system that we're going through, we're in a bad situation.
Y nosotros también estamos pasando, tratando de pasar una ley local en Nueva Orleans para proteger a los trabajadores del robo de sueldo.
And in New Orleans, we're trying to pass a law to protect workers from wage theft.
Y estábamos contentos porque el 27 de este pasado se iba a aprobar que entrara la enmienda.
The 26th of this last month, it looks like they're going to approve the law.
Y se ve lo injusto que son las personas que están en altos poderes que.
You can see how unjust the people in the high powers
que nosotros
are.
Ponemos
we put
en los poderes para traer por nosotros.
We put them in those places to work for us.
Y están para otro lado, entonces.
And they're over on the other side.
Y entonces.
You're listening to Flashpoints on the Pacifica Network. Those were the voices of activists from around the U.S. giving testimonials about their struggles in their own communities. Again, these sounds are from the U.S. Social Forum, which occurred last week in Detroit, Michigan. We move from there to an interview I did there last weekend about an exciting new national network for an exciting new project linking domestic workers around the country.
My name is Randy Jackson, and I'm the national coordinator for the Inter-Alliance Dialogue. And the Inter-Alliance Dialogue is a project that brings together six national alliances and networks that are made up of grassroots membership-based organizations. The six alliances include Grassroots Global Justice, Jobs with Justice, National Day Labor Organizing Network, National Domestic Workers Alliance, the Pushback Network, and the Right to the City Alliance.
And what are the main issues that you're focusing on or that these groups are focusing on? And just correct me if I'm wrong, these are from all around the country, right?
Yeah, each of those alliances are nationally based. They have grassroots membership organizations based throughout the country. Some of the networks and alliances are rooted in a particular sector. For example, National Day Labor Organizing Network focuses on the organization of day laborers. National Domestic Workers focuses on the organization of domestic workers. Now, each of those, even though they may be sector specific, they have an intentionality of bridging with other sectors and across issues because they have an analysis that sees the root causes of the problems as being broader than just their sector. Other networks, for example, like Grassroots Global Justice, bring together a whole variety of sectors and organizations ranging from peace groups to indigenous organizations, environmental justice groups, trade unions, and Jobs with Justice is primarily focused on coalitions that are based at the local level that bring together organized labor with religious groups, community-based organizations to strengthen the labor movement from the grassroots. Right to the City Alliance is focused on base building organizations that are reclaiming the right to the city, to public services, to public housing, to those things within the urban core that people feel are required and necessary to sustain a just and dignified life in the city. And the Pushback Network is a network that's formed up of state-based alliances. So it has, there are a number of states in which they have several grassroots organizations that are engaged in electoral work within those states to try to transform the relationships and balance of power.
So we're here now in Detroit at the U.S. Social Forum, where all these groups just recently got together and met and came out with some resolutions. Can you talk a little bit about what those resolutions were? And from what I heard, some of them were related to the Senate Bill 1070 in Arizona. If you could elaborate on those ideas, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Well, the Inter-Alliance Dialogue came into the U.S. Social Forum with the presumption that in order for us to be able to address the key issues of our time, that we would need to have a concerted movement building approach, one that was rooted in our base communities, in the communities where the people who are most impacted by the problems of economic exploitation, racial injustice, and white supremacy and racism, and environmental injustice should be at the forefront of a struggle for a new world. But we also recognize that we can't do that alone, that our communities and constituencies can't do it alone, and so we want to unite with other sectors and forces that have a progressive vision for social change. And so we came into the U.S. Social Forum under the banner of a movement for justice, dignity, and Mother Earth. And the name of that movement is called Basta Ya, Enough is Enough, a movement for justice, dignity, and Mother Earth. And what we're doing is we're lifting up what we think are three central issues. The issue of the economic recovery and the need for full and fair employment and a just economic recovery that actually lifts up every single family in this country to have the opportunity for a just and dignified and living wage, and an economic recovery program that actually is sponsored by the U.S. government, that doesn't look at bailing out the banks but actually lifting up the economic conditions of the people. We see that, you know, if we do not act now, the existence of humanity on this planet is threatened by a climate crisis, and that can't get any worse than it actually is. And the Gulf Coast, well, it can get much worse than it actually is. But if we don't intervene now, we are looking at, you know, decades of existence. The Gulf Coast, the oil spill is one key example of the degree in which that crisis has accelerated. And we also see that there's a crisis around the question of racism and xenophobia with the emergence of SB 1070 in Arizona. But we see these as all being interrelated, that they have that economic forces and the economic collapse is going to have an impact on the environmental crisis, that the environmental crisis actually is the main cause for global migration trends. And so if we don't address them in an interconnected fashion, then we're not going to be able to make the advances that we need to in order to find the solutions that we need.
Would it be possible to talk a little bit about some of the struggles that the people that were here, the organizations that are here represented at this People's Movement Assembly, have been dealing with?
Sure. So, you know, just to showcase one, you mentioned SB 1070. There's a group, a base building group called Puente Arizona, that is a member of the National Day Labor Organizing Network. They've been organizing for years to counteract the racist policies of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, who's created a tent city and is, you know, forcing people of color, black, brown, immigrant, indigenous, you name it, into a form of indentured servitude in these tent cities, and penalizing them for minor misdemeanors and making them serve time beyond what's required. So they've been launching that fight for many years, and so they were well poised to actually intervene when SB 1070 came on the books. But SB 1070 is actually, the roots of SB 1070 are rooted in the fact that national immigration policy has allowed for these insidious collaboration between immigration and customs enforcement and local law enforcement authorities, which and the belief, our belief is that, you know, law the enforcement of federal policy is solely the terrain of federal agencies. These policies are ripping up families, separating children from their mothers and fathers who are being deported back to their countries of origin, and ripping apart the fabric of communities.
So you yourself are coming from New York. What kind of things are you seeing there that are being responded to by these alliances?
Well, one thing, critical campaign to lift up in New York is the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights campaign that Domestic Workers United and the New York Domestic Workers Alliance in New York has been engaged in a 10-year-long battle to win a state bill signed by the governor, endorsed by both the House and Senate, to grant and extend protections to domestic workers. And this would be the first bill of its kind in the country that actually extends labor protections to primarily immigrant women who work in the domestic work industry. So that's one critical struggle. Another is that the fact that, you know, New York being an urban core has seen the impact of the economic crisis, skyrocketing levels of unemployment, especially in African American and immigrant communities, upwards of 20%. And the deterioration of low-income public housing, and in its stead, what we've seen is you know the construction of these mega complex luxury condominiums, which are now, because of the economic crisis, laying vacant, and so New York Right to the City has launched a campaign to try to reclaim those empty condominiums, and they've done a campaign to survey how many of those condominiums are actually vacant, so that they can put forward a proposal to use to convert those condos into low-income public housing.
My name's Steve Norris. I'm from St. Petersburg, Florida, and I'm with PPERC. I got interested in PPERC after I lost my job managing a research facility for a university in Florida, and I lost my home subsequently because of that. And Reverend Bruce Wright, who runs a refuge in St. Pete, it's a refuge for homeless people and for people suffering from the disease of addiction. And I got interested through meeting them, and I started finding out about Sherry Honkla, who's kind of the president of this. And And I had never heard of her or the organization before, but then I started, you know, hearing about it. And I went online, researched PPERC, started seeing housing takeovers that she had organized, and found out she'd been an activist for like 30 years experience. And I became really interested in that. I had a couple of employees lose their homes while working for me. It didn't affect me personally. And I was sympathetic to it, and I'm compassionate towards other human beings, but it didn't affect me. So I didn't even get involved. I didn't even ask them if I could help them or how I could help them. And after I started to lose my home, then I started to think about that. I really started to reflect on that there were two human beings that I worked with for years and losing their homes, and I didn't reach out to them at all. And I really had to reflect on that. So I went on this march to open my eyes, you know, to really take a look and see what's going on in this country. And it's really scary. It's really scary.
Can Can you talk a little bit about what you saw in the march and the experiences you've had since being in P-Park?
My situation, it's kind of a twofold thing. In my personal situation, what led up to losing my home was me losing a job and my ex-wife, who was my wife at that point in time, quitting her job to take care of her dad because they had no health insurance. And these were hard-working Americans who worked their whole lives. Her mother put 30 years in at this mining company in Virginia, and a year before she was to retire with full benefits, they closed it down, and she had a choice. She could take an early retirement with no benefits or nothing. So they're uninsured, and these are people that worked their whole lives in the same situation with their dad. So a medical situation along with me losing my job caused my situation. And I've seen it. I prior to this happening, I saw it's an NBC correspondent, actually, that was a war correspondent in South America. He had a similar situation, and it was something I'd never heard of. There's this thing called a lifetime cap on your insurance. And that is a sum of money that your insurance company will pay over your lifetime and no more. And his wife became ill. And I started seeing cars disappear from his home and that sort of thing. And he was kind of tight-lipped and then come to find out that he had hit the cap. His wife was ill, cancer, and he lost his home. Now, this is somebody who should be stable. This is somebody who should never have to go through that. And I myself, I did what you're supposed to do as an American citizen. I invested my money. I had IRAs. I had mutual funds. In fact, I lived off those assets for a year while trying to sell my home. And in Florida, the housing market, the bubble, hit there. And a home that was valued at $300, I couldn't sell for $150. So that's the reality of what's happening in America now. So once I left that and went on the road in this march, I'm from the South. And in the South, you see poverty. Poverty's been there in the South. It's been there for a long time. So I guess I had grown used to it because you could kind of avoid it in the South. Because poverty is in places that have always had poverty. It's always kind of been the tale of two cities in the South to a degree. But as we came north to see these industrial towns where people were middle class working in these huge middle class neighborhoods, and then all of a sudden they have these huge factories close, and there's these middle class neighborhoods that are just desolated. It's like a war, and it's like you're at ground zero of a war. And I see all these middle class, like when we went through Flint and some of those places to see all these houses that were burned, I couldn't believe it. Every third or fourth house in some neighborhoods was actually torched. And these are beautiful homes. And then you look around at all these homeless people and there's all these homes. What's going on? It's just insane, and there's got to be change, when you see that. And it was really, really hit. We were in Benton Harbor which is
quite near here,
Right. And what we really saw there was the true tale of two cities. As we were leaving we were actually leaving to go get lunch, we're driving past million-dollar homes on the water, and they were pristine and beautiful. And then it's right from there into these really, really poverty-stricken neighborhoods. And I realized that, what I didn't see? Middle-class homes. That's what I didn't see. None, I think in a way that's good for the movement. It's, of course, awful for the American people. But, I think that's really what has to happen. Middle-class America has to get angry. And they have to get involved, and they're starting to. Foreclosures, well, I think it's every 13 seconds there's a foreclosure in this country. That's staggering, I think, it's like Abraham Lincoln said, God bless the middle class income taxpayer, because, we're funding the country. And here I am, I'm becoming the new face of homelessness in America. It's changing what's happening right now, and I was one of those people that this didn't affect me. I wasn't involved, because I felt untouchable. And I think a lot of American middle-class people do feel untouchable because they're doing the right things. And the moral to this story is you can do the right things and still end up homeless. And it's happening really fast. And it was really eye-opening to be on this trip and to see all these displaced people, It's sad. And I can't understand, even before I got involved in activism, I was agitated by it, and I just don't understand why more Americans aren't angry, especially with the bailouts, things like that. I was already angry, and I just don't understand why more Americans aren't really, really angry about what's going on.
Is there anything you would like to say to folks who are going through some of the same situations that you did, losing their house because of healthcare, because of these kind of horrible issues that are a huge pattern around this country?
Yes, I would. Get involved. Get involved. There's people out there that will help. There's organizations that'll help. RFP Perk, you can go on the website and find out what's going on there. There's a lot of really good information on there. And what's happening now is there's a big movement in America, and it's evident here in this forum where we have 20 to 40,000 people. They're all here for the same reason. There's got to be change, and it's not just here; it's globally. And I wasn't even aware, prior to this, that this existed. But I guarantee you, no matter where you live and who you are or whoever's listening to this program, there's people, there's organizations, there's activists out there that can help you. And if nothing else, they'll engineer and be sympathetic. This organization itself and several others have become involved in housing takeovers. People are, I wouldn't say they're getting militant, but they're angry and they're tired of it, and they're willing to go take back homes. It's ridiculous when you have all these empty homes, when you have, thousands of HUD homes in America that our government owns, and no one's living in them, and people are living on the street, so get involved and look around, get educated, educate yourself about what's going on, and find out what's really going on in this country, and take action.
So we'll put the link to the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign's website on our website, which is flashpoints.net. But we're all here at the Social Forum, where there's tons of events with people, activists from around the country, trying to think about how to create change, how to network. What kind of things have you seen here, and does it give you any hope?
I with everything that's going on now with what's happening with us here in this country, a lot of us can't help but focus on our personal problems. What's going on immediately with us, healthcare. Healthcare is huge. Healthcare and housing have to be two of the biggest issues. I personally don't have children. Selfishly, I don't think that much about education, but I know how important it is. It's so crucial. And I think those are three of the biggest things that we really have to tackle. And when you look at, everybody needs to sit down, and they just need to one time pull up online where our money's being spent. Notice that half of the pie goes to the Pentagon, and the rest of it is slivered into little slivers for what we need as people, what I found out here at this forum is I found a lot of information about where our money's going. And I kind of knew it to a degree, but to see it, to really see it with people who are knowledgeable of it, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. That's the bottom line. And I also got to sit in on some panels concerning the Afghan war and the Iraq war. As much as you don't maybe think that that's affecting you, it is, because we're spending trillions of dollars. So it is affecting. It is affecting all of us. We're losing our homes, we're losing health care, and we're spending trillions of dollars in these countries, and most of us don't even really know what's going on there.
In Detroit, this is Jesse Strauss reporting for Flashpoints. You're listening to the Pacifica Radio Network. We are at the U.S. Social Forum right now. I'm sitting with folks from the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign. That's PHERC. Right now I'm speaking with Tony, who was with that group for part of the March to Fulfill the Dream. Tony, how do you feel about the U.S. Social Forum so far and your experience here and also on that march that you told me about a few minutes ago?
Well, I feel that the Social Forum is a good event. I feel like it's very inspiring to meet people from all walks of life and from all nationalities, all colors, all creeds, all ways of life, who are actually coming together to fight for human rights, who are coming together to say that they are here to activate for change. And it's amazing to me because this is actually my first social forum that I've been to, and it's my first event like this that I've been to ever in my life. And it's amazing to me because, I came up here from Mobile, Alabama, in an isolated community where we are actually behind times in the sense of education, human rights, economics, you know, anything you can name, you know. And to come here and see that we're not alone in our fight for equality, you know. There's very diverse backgrounds here, and everyone is working to fight for equality, to uplift the poor, to end poverty, to end human rights abuses, to end inequality in the media, you know. And it's so much. So far, I'm just the tip of the iceberg, you know. And it moves you from a feeling of being in the minority to really being into the majority. Because it seems to me that the majority of people want change, you know, and this is not represented in the mainstream media, you know. So things like this are very important, and I feel like it's very inspiring to me, and it's very informational to me, you know, to see that you're not alone, you know.
And you said you're coming from Mobile, Alabama, and you're here really fighting for human rights is what you said.
Exactly. You know, equality across the economic spectrum and the human rights spectrum for poor people. The end of poverty, equal housing, fair housing, you know, as a right, not just as a privilege, but as a right, you know.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in Mobile, Alabama, more specifically, that really needs to be struggled against?
Well, basically, you have the homeless people down there in Mobile, Alabama, who are really being discriminated against in the sense that it was a big tourist town, you know. It's a tourist town, and it's on the Gulf Coast. Of course, they have the oil spill down there now that's affecting it. And, you know, as this old saying, stuff flows downhill, you know. So they getting the brunt of it now, even worse, now even more so than before, you know. And they're being harassed. They don't want them. They're passing laws against panhandling on the street. You know, they're passing laws against the soup kitchens who feed the homeless on the street. They're passing laws against them under the guise of health department, violations of the health department. You know, they're using the law and twisting it in order to stop people from helping these poor homeless people. You know what I mean? And these are the things that are happening, particularly in that area, you know. And now that the oil spill is going on, and BP is like the devil's curse. They caused the oil spill, which damaged the economy down there even more than it was done, heaped on more damage. And now they're hiring people to do these oil spill jobs, giving them like 4-hour classes on hazmat control. And it's not really preparing for the handling of that crude oil, you know. So nobody's taking into effect the healthcare costs that's going to be coming down the line with people that are desperate for jobs, and they go to work for these oil spill cleanup jobs, and they're in contact with that crude oil and the healthcare costs down the line. Nobody's thinking about that, you know. So it's just another form of imperialism, you know, where the imperialists has caused the problem, and now they're throwing money on top of it to cover it up, you know. So that's what's going on down there in Mobile, Alabama right now. So it's a lot of depression with the people who rely on making their living off of the Gulf, you know, from the fisheries to the restaurants, you know, to the food seafood processors, and they're depressed because they don't have no work, you know. They don't have no jobs, you know, and they're seeing their whole livelihood threatened, you know. So after BP leaves, you know, they're still going to have to face the economic and environmental damage that has been caused. So that's what's happening in Mobile right now.
So it sounds like there's some hard situations going on in Mobile, and the oil in the Gulf is making it that much worse. It also sounded like, from what you were saying earlier, that being here at the Social Forum, it's giving you some hope for better change. Is there specific things that you think are going to get better? Is there specific things that you think might even get worse? I mean, the oil is very daunting.
It is a lot. Who can fathom it? No one can exponentially calculate the effects of this spill. You know, the oil hasn't even been stopped from gushing out of the seafloor yet. So there's no way for us to calculate. There's no way, you know, possible for us to even estimate the damage, you know. So until the oil is actually stopped, then we can start making some calculations on how much damage and what's going to be the cost of rebuilding and restoring the communities, you know what I mean? Even to the level that they were, which was not very good in the first place, you know? But even to that level, you know, we can't calculate as of yet. So it's, you know, it's like a wait and see type attitude that's been going on, you know, and everybody's, you know, it's just very depressed. Everybody's very, it's mass depression going on, you know, and it's very sad. But coming here, on a lighter note, coming here to the forum has given me ideas, has given me inspiration, particularly in the areas of healthcare, you know. Now is the time for healthcare for all. You know, it's now is the time to push for that, you know, and this belabors the point, you know, that healthcare is all is definitely needed, because the cost of the health care that has not been contemplated down there in the Gulf Coast needs to be addressed. Not 20 years down the line, but right now, because we know that it's coming down the pipe. So we know we need to get some health care for all now, for these poor people who can't afford health care, you know, and also the housing situation. We have an opportunity where a lot of people are getting these jobs from this oil spill, so they need housing while they have the opportunity to make this money and pay for their utilities and so forth and so on, you know. So housing needs to be addressed. Put the people who need housing in housing, you know. So a lot, one of the things in particular that's going on with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign is that they are doing housing takeovers and the land rights for all, you know. So that is something that can be done down there in Mobile, Alabama, that I feel that is one thing that can be done, taken back from the forum and taken back down there and implemented.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Jesse Strauss, reporting from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, and we're speaking with Tony from the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign. You just mentioned some housing takeovers that were happening, Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign was doing. Can you speak on what that means, and for people that might not be familiar with what that is and what the goals of that is?
Okay. What that is giving poor people housing that they need. And by taking abandoned houses or houses that have been foreclosed upon and taking over those houses and getting poor people who have the income, you know, to sustain their utilities and their basic needs, you know, who can't afford to get into a house because of the down payments or the rent and back rent and so forth and so on. But they do have enough to maintain once they're into the house, you know. And what it is, what we do is we go to the foreclosed homes who are abandoned and no one's living there, and we take over, you know. We go there and we get the basic necessities and utilities going, and we put a needy family into the house, you know, and once they maintain that, then the house is theirs, you know, rent free, and until the landowner comes forth, you know, he can accept the rent, you know, that's being paid out, or so forth and so on, because the house is just there abandoned and not being used. So we're making use of these homes, you know, that are not being used. So that's what we feel like we're kind of recycling waste, you know what I mean?